The title of this talk is, or this Dharmette, is The Problem with Being a Good Meditator. As many of you know, if you come here regularly, I lead the month-long, February month-long at Spirit Rock each year, and really enjoyed the month-long retreat this past year that ended the beginning of the end of February, and the month-long is about 55 or so people who are there for 1 month, and about another 30 or so, 25 or 30, who are there for 2 months. They stay the second month when another teaching crew comes in, and then another 55 or 60 or so come for the for that second month. And I just happened to be there last week. I was teaching this 3-day non-residential retreat with Bob Doppelt, which was really a pleasure, Dharma and climate change and things like that. But I happened to be there when the 2-month retreat just was ending, and just when silence was broken. So I got to see all the people who were ending the retreat, and in particular, I was interested in checking in with the people that I had worked with and supported from that first month. And it's really not only is it an honor to be in that position of helping support people and guide people, but it's so inspiring and just seeing how the practice works. It does work. All of the people have glow on their face. Sometimes it's called the Vipassana facelift. You know, they look about 10 years younger, whatever their age is, and just glowing and so open and just no armoring, and really radiant. As sometimes can happen, the reentry after you're so open is a delicate process, and we talk about that at the end of the retreat. Often I'll give the analogy: when I end a retreat, it's like I'm a newborn baby. There's all the armoring is down, and there are many moments where you're just saying, "Wow, look at the world! Gee, it's so brilliant and vivid and bright and alive." And then it's, "Whoa, this is way too much. This is a lot of stimulation, and I need to kind of ground myself and regroup." And this is a natural part of the process, particularly if you understand that you're not doing anything wrong. It just takes a while to go from the slow lane to the faster lane. And there are, you learn to be more and more understanding with the process as you go through energy changes, and sometimes seeing things more than you normally would, and seeing places inside that, I still have my personality. I remember the first time I did a long retreat, and I did my first 3-month retreat, which they do, they hold every year at Insight Meditation Society, and I opened my mouth for during the integration part. It's sometimes called integration week. And I opened up my mouth and there was, you know, judgment, paranoia, insecurity, and I went running to my teacher saying it didn't work. And he reminded me it's not about getting rid of anything, it's about really seeing it all and not taking it personally and learning to love every part of ourselves. So you go through a little bit of bumpy waters and you just give yourself enough space to go through that, and then you kind of come back and you come back from with a deeper connection to a place of home than you had when you started. You know, I don't want to frighten people off and say, well, I don't know if I'm ready for one of those things. It's definitely worth it. And like anything, there's an adjustment period for a little while afterwards. Anyway, I was checking in one of the people on this retreat said that they wanted to check in with me because it's been a little one of those periods of adjustment, and she had a really fabulous retreat when I was working with her and speaking to one of the teachers who worked with her for the second month. Fabulous in the sense that she really got to a place of equanimity and okayness with everything, and she wasn't fighting the moment at all. And she's got a strong practice. And one of her friends who was on the retreat, who also had a very wonderful, extraordinary experience. And theirs had a different flavor than hers. They experienced some states of concentration, strong concentration, which can happen from time to time, where you're kind of in an altered space and it's very bells and whistles and things like that. And as much as she cares about her friend, when she heard that, she said for a while it was, as much as she was happy for her friend, she got into this spinning in her head, well, I didn't have that. And she, from this really great place, she started, the comparing mind started to play, and she was thinking, oh God, what did I miss out on it? And gee, I wish I, why didn't I, you know, could have done this, or I didn't have that. And so she wanted to check in with me. And we had a really wonderful talk. She understood that not only do you get just the right retreat for you, but she was missing the fact that bells and whistles are not necessarily where it's at. As wonderful as they are, you can get caught in thinking, oh, that's the real practice. So as we were talking, it made me remember a couple of passages from the teachings, a couple of different pointers to this, and I wanted to read to you from one discourse from the Anguttara Nikaya. This is an excerpt that's put in this wonderful book. If you ever see the book called The Island by Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro, an anthology of the Buddhist teachings on Nibbana, it's a free book, which makes it harder to get a hold of. But I think the whole thing is probably online for free. Anyway, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, a collection of the Buddha's discourses. And this is the story. Then Venerable Anuruddha, this is one of the most famous disciples of the Buddha, went to where Venerable Sariputta was staying. Sariputta is one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. And Anuruddha, it was a master of psychic powers and able to see far realms and all kinds of psychic powers. That was one of the things he was known for. So he went to Venerable Sariputta and on arrival greeted him courteously. After an exchange of friendly greetings, he said to Venerable Sariputta, "By means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, what most humans can have, I see the thousandfold cosmos." He's having a pretty good retreat. "My energy is aroused and unsluggish. My mindfulness is established and unshaken. My body is calm and unaroused. My mind is concentrated into singleness." These are the various of the seven factors of enlightenment. "And yet my mind is not released from the outflows through lack of clinging." That's another way of saying, "And yet I know I'm not enlightened. I am getting all the bells and whistles here you could hope for, but I'm not enlightened. What's the problem?" And Sariputta answers, "My friend, when the thought occurs to you, 'By means of the divine eye purified and surpassing the human, I see the thousandfold cosmos,' that is related to your conceit." What in the teachings, one of the fetters or defilements is called mana, or the conceit of I am, of I, look at me. Okay, either look at me, aren't I wonderful, or look at me, I'm not as good as you. It's just, or look at me, I'm separate from you. They're all the same in that category of conceit, but this is particularly around conceit. Hey, look at me, I'm pretty cool here. "When the thought occurs to you, 'My energy is aroused and unsluggish, my mindfulness is established and unshaken, my body is calm and unperturbed, my mind is concentrated into singleness,' that is related to your restlessness." And restlessness in this sense is there is the conceit gives rise to, things are good, but they're not good enough. And then he says, "When the thought occurs to you, 'And yet my mind is not released from the outflows through lack of clinging,' that is related to your anxiety. It would be well if, abandoning these three qualities, not attending to these three qualities, you directed your mind to the deathless element," which is another way of saying, let go of all your accomplishment and tune into the reality that is beyond look at me. The deathless element is another way of saying towards nibbana or nirvana. So after that, Venerable Anuruddha, abandoning those three qualities, not attending to those three qualities of anxiety, restlessness, and conceit, directed his mind to the deathless element. Dwelling alone, secluded, heedful, ardent, and resolute, he in no long time reached and remained in the supreme goal of the holy life, for which people rightly go forth from home into homelessness, knowing and realizing it for himself in the here and now. He knew birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is no more coming into any state of being, and thus Venerable Anuruddha became another one of the arhants, fully enlightened beings. Like most of these stories, he got it. He just needed to hear the right words. This is something that is a little bit of a trap for, can be a big trap for practitioners. If you happen to fall into a really delicious state, it can be a problem. Not that the state itself is a problem, but in thinking, that's it. I got it. Any state is going to be a temporary experience. And particularly if you take ownership of that state, look at me. This is sometimes referred to in Mahayana teachings as the stink of enlightenment. It looks really good, but this is not a truly liberated mind and heart. In Theravadin teachings, there is a different stages of the process, what's called the progress of insight, and at one stage, it gets really delicious. Bells and whistles, where just like Anuruddha, the different factors of enlightenment, there are seven factors of enlightenment, come on really strong. There's strong mindfulness, strong investigation, strong energy, strong joy or bliss, strong calm, concentration, and equanimity. And you see a lot. But this can easily turn into what is called the corruptions of insight. They're called the corruptions of insight at this particular stage because they feel so good that you can either think you're enlightened or you get really attached to them and say, this is where it's at. I want more of this. So it's corruption because even though those are beautiful qualities of the mind and the heart, there is grasping in the mind either for the experience or a grasping at the ownership of them. Look at me. Anybody ever have a really sweet experience in meditation saying, hey, I think I kind of got this now? Can anybody relate to that? No. It depends. You have to have had a good experience. So if you didn't, then you just kind of, oh, they sound good. Gee, I wish I could have. Notice if your mind is saying, oh, I wish I could have one of those. I'll just share a couple of more points, and then we can look at this. First time I did a retreat, my own intensive practice retreat. This is in 1974. I had this one meditation period where it was the first time I ever had this experience where I was so enjoying myself that it didn't matter if the bell never rang. You know, it was like, there was a part of me saying, oh gosh, I hope this bell doesn't ring. It's so cool. It was like, I was breathing in and the universe was breathing out. And I was breathing out and the universe, we were just in harmony. And it was really cool. And over the course of the next couple of days, every time I sat, it was, wow, maybe it'll happen again. And I had every kind of meditative experience except that. Mostly I got confused, I was grasping, I crashed, I was spun out, and then I went into an interview. We have interviews every few days on retreat, and I went to my teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who was there, and I said, you know, I had it a couple of days ago, and I lost it. Could you tell me how I get back there? And he told me this story that I was so grateful that it happened on my first retreat, about his own practice, where he was practicing in India. He practiced for about 7 years, better part of 7 years straight. And he got to this place in his practice where every time he sat, his body was just so clear and brilliant, and his mind was light, and it went on for some time. He was just grooving, feeling really good, and then he went home for he was visiting his family at home, and he got out of practice. He knew he was going to go back to India in another month or so, and he didn't practice much. And just, you know, got into being at home and hanging out. And then he went back to India, and he was telling me this. He said, and I remembered really clearly how things were. And he said, I sat down hoping to get back to where I was. And then he said, I spent nearly 2 years trying to recreate that experience. He said, I sat down, and my body was like twisted steel, those are the words that he used, and my mind was like mud. And I spent 2 years trying to recreate that experience. And then he looked at me and he said, I was the dummy. I did it for you. You don't have to be the dummy. I said, thank you very much, Joseph. Yeah. Wow, thank you. And was reminded, and even though his teachers, he was practicing with his teachers, and they said, just be with things as they are. And yet there was this compulsion, oh, maybe now. And then after, at some point, he let go of trying to recreate that experience, and his practice took off in a whole other direction, in a whole other way. So that was one story that impressed upon me. And then another personal experience where I saw a glimpse of not taking ownership of the experience. I might have shared this in before here. I was in one of these longer retreats, and I was in a really wonderful space where I was just, things were going well. I was sitting for long stretches at a time, and my body was clear, and my mind was pretty clear, and on one of these longer sitting sessions, somebody came into the hall who I had tremendous respect for as far as their practice, And they sat down, and I would sometimes sit with my eyes open just to let in the light. And they sat down, and after about 10 minutes, they were doing a classic nods. This is called the nods. We kind of go like this. And it was mystifying to me. Here was this yogi who I had great respect for. She sits down and she's just nodding off after 10 minutes. And I'm sitting there for hours, and I don't know how it happened, but there was energy and I was clear. And I know very well what it's like to be in the nods. I've spent many hours in that mode, probably weeks if you put them all together. And it occurred to me the next day that could be me. And I had no idea how I somehow ended up in the state that I was in. But all of a sudden, realizing how that could be me tomorrow, something happened in my mind in the room, and each person meditating was their own field of energy, where here was sleepiness, here was energy and clarity, here might have been loving kindness, here might have been calm, here might have been compassion or joy. That was just in that moment where the configurations were. But when I saw it, it was just these energies that were visiting each of these beings. In a moment, it was like the whole room kind of spun around, and realizing that we could all be switching places in the next hour, let alone day. And the thought of me doing it made no sense at all. I had no idea how that happened, but there I was, and to take credit for it was completely missing the point. And that was much more impactful and profound than the delicious state that I was in. Just seeing, I can't take ownership of this. All I could do is say, amazing grace. Oh, this is what a gift this is right now. And to take any kind of credit would be truly getting into that stink of practice. And as I was sharing with my friend who had sat at the retreat, and just seeing the real freedom is letting go of you thinking you're controlling the show. The real freedom is just opening up to whatever life is giving you right now and learning to be with that. If it's calm, oh, this is calm, Buddha. If it's meltdown, oh, this is meltdown, Buddha. If it's bliss, oh, this is bliss, Buddha. If it's boredom or sleepiness, this is boredom or boring Buddha or sleepy Buddha, meaning it's just what has moved through us. So I offer that to you to really see that you don't have to make anything happen in this practice. And in fact, the more you try to make something happen, the more you're getting caught in the illusion that I can control my experience. And that I is the problem. When there's no I, when it's just, oh, this is how life is moving through me at this moment, and there's an awareness that doesn't take it personally, that's the freedom. Isn't that freeing? Nothing that you need to manipulate, nothing that you need to create or make happen, nothing that you need to get rid of, nothing that you need to embellish. It's all passing anyway. It's all going to come and go and come and go. So your job is to just be here for the changing scenes and not take credit or blame, but just be here with things as they are. That's the real freedom. So, I'll stop here and this point, if you either have anything that you want to bring up from that or about practice in general, I'd really like to hear what's going on with your practice, either both on the cushion or off the cushion. We can take some time. And would you be willing, Jackie? And when you speak like this, not like this, like this. What's up for you? Yeah. Tom. Okay.
Yeah. Hi. I'm curious about the length. You mentioned that you sat for hours. Somehow I get this impression that 45 minutes is sort of an optimum time, but I hear about sitting lot longer, and you just mentioned it seemed like. Is there any guidance at all about that, or does it matter?
You know, sitting for 45 minutes, my pact with myself is that I'll get into the posture every day. So if it's a choice between 5 minutes or none at all, do the 5 minutes. The getting in the posture is the main thing. Sitting for, you know, if you can sit for a half an hour or 45 minutes at a time, that's great. The longer kind of practice, it's not something that you can make happen. You know, if you're doing it like a samurai, I'm going to sit here and just not move for the next 3 hours, you know. Then it's just your ego. It's more like when that happens, you're kind of there for the ride. And you can't make it happen. So when somebody is on retreat, sometimes they get into that kind of a flow, and then I'll say, sit until there's a reason to get up, and walk, and you can do the same thing with walking practice. You know, walk as long as you're cruising and really there, keep on walking. It's good if you've done a long sit to do some walking so that you're grounded. But, you know, sometimes you can sit for many hours. Just kind of happens. And again, it's like you're just there for the ride. I don't know how that happened, but there it is. It's like, holy cow. And that actually shows you just how selfless the thing is, because you didn't make it happen. Is just kind of happening all on its own. It's just the little tweak that makes all the difference. In the moment there's, hey, look at this. You've just taken credit for something that's completely been out of your control. But as soon as you switch it to, wow, isn't this amazing? You know, then there's that a true humility that's not taking credit for it. Sometimes it happens, you know. You can't make it. You can't force it, though.
Yeah. My question is a little bit different in that I don't know much about Buddhism. I can just tell you that I'm in search. And through my search, Buddhism has continued to resurface itself. In the last month, everywhere I've gone, it's kind of resurfaced. Uh-huh. I think so. My question more or less is, because I'm trying to get understanding, is Buddhism the meditation or is it just the way of life?
It's both. The ism actually, you know, the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. The Buddha was this man who lived 2,600 years ago who said it's possible to free the mind of hatred and grasping and wanting. It's possible to experience a deep peace inside. And he had some guidelines for doing that. But he said, this is all something for you to check out for yourself. Don't take, and one of the thing that hooked me was he said, don't take my word for it. Don't believe anybody. You just see for yourself what leads to suffering and what leads to happiness. And he did say that the cornerstone of training the mind and the heart is to learn to be present for your experience without wanting, without the mind grasping onto the pleasant or pushing away the unpleasant, to really see clearly. This is that the mindfulness meditation, which is now, you know, used in Kaiser and in schools and in business and all. And, you know, mindfulness has become, and there's lots of research done on it. He said, if you train the mind and the heart to learn how to pay attention, then you will see what leads to happiness and what leads to suffering. And there is a prescription that he gave for doing that, which includes not harming others or yourself through your speech, through your actions, through your livelihood. It includes training the mind and the heart in the meditation, developing mindfulness and concentration. And it also includes understanding some basic principles of reality, that everything is changing, that there is the law of cause and effect, that things aren't happening random, that you can train the mind and the heart. So he laid out a prescription that he said, just check this out. And at the heart of that prescription is learning to train the mind and the heart to be very present. So it's both, it's a philosophy, it's a way of life of interacting with the world around you and learning to make friends with yourself inside. And it's also, it includes very effective practices. It's not just conceptual. There are practices that anyone can learn to train the mind and the heart. Does that do it?
Hi. So I'm fairly new in meditation, and I'm curious what I find is that my idea of what it is to meditate, sort of informed by various books and teachings that I've experienced, I find myself focusing on my back and my posture and little moving pains a lot. And so what I experience as meditation is a lot of subtle adjusting of my body. Mm. And then sometimes this question of like, should I move to be more comfortable or should I focus on experiencing the discomfort? And then And then there's this place of ambivalence of like, now I'm just sitting here thinking about whether to move my leg. And so I'm curious, because I was glancing up at you and I'm like, is he moving? Is he shifting around? And so there's always this little shifting of like, if I move an inch back, does that make my spine feel better? If I move an inch forward? And I find that that's kind of where my attention goes when I'm doing what I think of as meditating.
Mm-hmm. So, it's great that you're tracking all of that. That's the, you know, don't miss out on the fact that you're seeing what's going on inside. Should I move? Shouldn't I move? What's the right way? Oh, there I'm thinking about it. And that's confusing. Now I'm noticing that I'm thinking about it. First of all, just appreciate that you're seeing all of that. Okay. And if you can keep your sense of humor with the whole thing, it helps a lot. As far as when you're sitting, you're sitting cross-legged, I guess, on the floor. Is that what's that? You're doing kneeling. So one thing you might do is find a posture that you can be most comfortable and still. And there's nothing holy about sitting on the floor. There's something, if you can or get used to it, there's something about keeping your spine straight that brings some alertness. But sooner or later, you're going to probably hear your body saying, hey, pay attention to me. And you might find comfort in knowing even the Buddha had back aches, and it's in the discourses he would tell Sariputta to give the discourse while he rested his back. It's nothing to be, you know, you're not doing it wrong. You have a body. And so find a posture you can be reasonably straight and reasonably still, but not stiff. You want to be both a combination of upright and alert, and at the same time relaxed. So if there's any places of tension or holding, you allow them to soften. And then as far as when there's a discomfort, there's no right or wrong, but you might, here's a few ways to relate to it. First of all, when you see there's a discomfort, you probably notice your mind isn't wandering off someplace. You might wish it were someplace else, but there you are on your shoulder or your back or whatever. So in one way, it's an ally that can keep you here. But at some point, it's not to be a samurai and just see how tough you can be. So one way first to use the discomfort, and this is all done in a spirit of exploration and experimenting, is let the rest of your body be quite open and soft, because sometimes when there's a tension, we can tense up in response. Uh-oh, this is getting tight here. So you want to have the rest of your body quite soft. Maybe take a few deeper breaths so that there's some, so any kind of tension can be moved through with the breath. And then for just a little chunk of time, you might imagine like you're Sherlock Holmes with a magnifying glass, just checking out the area. Okay. Instead of, oh, here's pain, I don't know if I can handle it. What's going on here? Oh, there's tightness, there's sensation, there's pressure, there's burning or whatever. And I would make a little contract with myself, okay, for the next minute or half a minute, let's just check it out. Just check out the whole landscape. Because then you're there with it and interested in it. And then at the end of that half a minute or a minute, you might come back to take a break and stay, come back to the breath or notice your whole body sitting here. I would suggest doing that a couple of times, two or three times, just so you get a little bit of practice in being with an unpleasant sensation. Or you can notice the various shifts and just notice with interest, oh, look at the body doing its thing. But experiment with stillness. At some point, if it gets to be a struggle, then you don't get any extra credit for being there with the struggle. Then just say, okay, time to move, and moving, moving, and doing that as an awareness practice as well, so that you're seeing the shift. And sometimes you'll stay with it because it's interesting, or you're just feeling a sense of courage. And sometimes the most skillful thing will be to compassionately move. So there's no one right or wrong, just seeing, is this supporting me being here in a very interested and balanced way? Okay. What else? Anything else? About... Go ahead.
So what about meditating lying down?
What's that?
Lying down.
Lying down, yeah. Sounds good, doesn't it? lying down, you know, the Buddha said be in all four postures. You can be mindful standing, sitting, walking, lying down. So when you are lying down, it's a very good thing to be mindful. If you need to lie down because your body is struggling in the sitting up posture, then it's fine to lie down. There are some things to keep in mind. Keep your eyes open. You might look at a point on the ceiling, or you might have your hands up so you're a little bit more alert and present. The problem with lying down, you can guess, yeah. Which doesn't have to be a problem if it's late at night and you want to go to sleep. Then you might, instead of trying to get to sleep, try to stay mindful in a lying down position. You'll be out probably pretty soon, so you can use it to your advantage. But you just, if you need to take care of your body that way, then lying down is fine. That is the challenge. Is there one last one and then we'll go?
So this is more of an invitation for comment.
Uh-huh. Speak up just a bit.
Sorry, this is more of an invitation for comment rather okay. than question.
Okay.
And also just to know that I've been practicing for almost 20 years now mm-hmm. and some long retreats, many long retreats. Mm-hmm. So what's happening right now, I'm undergoing a remodel in the house, so I'm really, really, really busy. And with the political environment, also I'm busy trying to do what I can. Mm-hmm. But from time to time, a thought occurs to me. There are a lot of choices when it comes to remodel this, that, you know, this, that. Should I do this? Should I do that? From time to time, though, a thought is occurring to me, and the thought is, but this is not cessation, this is not peace.
This is not what?
This is not cessation, this is not peace.
This is not sensation.
Cessation. This is not cessation. This is not peace.
Yeah.
I have heard plenty of talks from the Burmese teacher, so this is not... I mean, I'm aware of the word cessation and what it means. And it's such a window to such a different world. I'm having a very hard, it's like I'm standing in the borderland, and I don't know how to reconcile the two impulses. And I have to just acknowledge it and then turn and do something completely different immediately. And there is a real pull, but I don't know what to do with it.
Wait, I'm, let me make sure I understand.
So it's as if I'm being called from time to time. I'm being called to another land.
To another
land.
What's of wanting to be at peace and
not doing anything but just peace, and it's not possible because I'm in the world and it's very busy, and I haven't even gone on a retreat for a year, and I don't think maybe another 6-8 months, but there's something pulling and it's worth nurturing, and I don't know how to nurture it in the busyness of it all.
Mm. And do you sit regularly?
Yes. About an hour every night.
And does that help you nurture it?
No. I mean, it just helps my body and mind stay calm. Maybe just be aware of it and just come back.
Just notice the wanting mind adds on to the suffering. Mm. That's how it works. Mm. That's kind of what I was trying to point out, that it doesn't matter if it's wanting a new car or wanting deep meditative peace. It's still the wanting mind. So
you
need to take a look and see how that wanting is adding more suffering onto what's here.
Wonderful. And, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, welcome. And be kind and patient with yourself, because the real peace is not dependent on the absence of stimulation. It's dependent on meeting things as they are in a wise relationship. Yeah. Good luck. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so let's close with a loving kindness, and let's hold those in our hearts and hold yourself in your heart and share your goodwill with all beings everywhere. May all come to the end of suffering. May all see things as they are. May all know the highest happiness. And may our coming here together tonight be of benefit to all beings everywhere. Thank you for your attention. Have a great week. Have a great couple of weeks. See ya.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.